We get it underway this afternoon by welcoming to the program writer, actor, comedian, producer, podcast host. You know him for his work on MST 3000 as a TV's Frank, or perhaps as Rudy Kazuti on Sabrina the Teenage Witch, where he was an executive story editor. He was the head writer as well for Invader Zim. He's the author of a number of books. He tours with Trace Bellew as the Mads, and he's got a brand new book out that is a wonderful read called Dark Apnea. Frank Conniff joins us. Frank, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I love the Rudy Kazuti deep cut. Not many people mention that.
Well, listen, when a man looks that good as a baby, it has to be mentioned.
That's right. I was, you know, it was my, I filmed that. I was in a crib dressed as a baby on my 40th birthday.
It's a heck of Very a way proud. To celebrate right there.
Yes, exactly.
So the new book is just an absolute blast to read. It's time. It's time for a superhero with a CPAP mask.
Thank you. Yeah, I thought that there was a lack of that in our popular culture, so I decided to do something about it.
What inspired you to write this tale? Because, you know, there's very little superhero stuff out there these days.
I know. I really felt that the one thing the world needed was another superhero story, because there's none in the movies or TV or anywhere. So the initial notion of this was just basically to give Batman the Get Smart treatment, you know, to do like a broad kind of silly, but dark but silly take on that kind of brooding, troubled, traumatized superhero that's such a big thing in our culture right now.
Well, and every superhero needs a terrific sidekick, and you introduced us to, I think, the best one yet, Unpaid Intern.
Yes, Unpaid Intern is his sidekick who comes to work for him as his unpaid intern and decides that that's going to be her superhero persona. She's kind of a more healthy version of Dark Apnea. She's pursuing a superhero career, but she's a little more has her head on her shoulders a little bit better than Dark Apnea. As is frequently the case, the person working for the person is better at the job than the person in charge.
And it's tough for Dark Apnea. I don't want to give away too much, but you know, you need that difficult past, and frankly, his isn't all that difficult, other than the sleep issues.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is he's like Batman, and similar to, you know, Batman, the big trauma in Batman's life happened when he left a theater with his parents, and then his parents were killed outside the theater. Dark Apnea has a very similar inciting incident in his life where he and his parents left the theater, and then a man jumps out of the dark alley and then engages his parents in a discussion about musical theater. And that's the traumatizing incident that follows Dark Apnea for the rest of his life.
I also enjoyed the cameo appearances by several of the members of Pink Floyd.
Well, that's in a dream sequence that comes later, where it involves, I know you see this in every superhero story, but it's a dream sequence involving Roger Waters from Pink Floyd and Joe Besser from the Three Stooges.
Who hasn't had that dream?
I know, we've all had that dream, and it's been dramatized many times, but I just can't come up with an original idea, so I put it in.
I'll tell you what, I'm not a big reality TV guy, but I would watch America's Got Confidence every week.
Yes, that's a show where Dark Apnea's arch nemesis, the Parodist, who is like the Joker, but he focuses mainly on song parodies. And imagine if Weird Al Yankovic was evil, which is the hardest thing in the world to imagine because he's the greatest person who ever lived. But this is like an evil song parodist. And he is on a show called America's Got Confidence, which is not based on your talent. It's based on how much confidence you have. And the less talent you have, the better it is, because then it's more impressive the confidence you show in yourself.
It was absolutely brilliant. I also appreciated, as a longtime follower of your posts on Twitter, I appreciated just a subtle little shot at the New York Times and their coverage of fascists.
Yes, I put that in, and I'm glad that you think it was subtle, because I didn't want to make a big deal, and I didn't want... You know, when I write fiction, and I've written a few works of fiction, I like to escape from the world of politics. I don't really delve into it. It's an escape for me. So, but the New York Times plays a part in this book, because the only press that he's ever gotten is the New York Times real estate section about his hunt for a superhero headquarters. Which, if you read the New York Times, you know that one of their regular features is a column, an actual column called "The Hunt," about people choosing where they're going to live, and they always have a list like which one did they choose, and they always like give a few listings. So that's his only press for most of the book, because it's a superhero origin story after all.
It is a brilliant book, Dark Apnea. You can get it anywhere fine books are sold, Amazon.com. You can go to Frank's website as well for more information. Frank Conniff with us here on Downtown. I want to go back a little bit to your origin story here. You had, is it safe to say, a challenging childhood? Your dad was a Pulitzer Prize winning columnist, but also was gone a lot, had some substance abuse issues. Your mom dealt with some mental health challenges. Was it a tough to be, what, one of five kids at the time?
Yeah, I mean, it was a difficult childhood. In many ways, I'm a very lucky, privileged person, and, my family is great. But there were, my dad was a workaholic, and, when I was very young, he, and being a journalist, he was on the road a lot, and he was literally covering like the biggest stories of the age. And his Pulitzer was for interviewing a Khrushchev in Russia. He was all over the world. And my mom suffered from mental health issues. So there was kind of a lack of guidance, and it was kind of a crazy household to be brought up in, a lot of instability. And but the good news is it automatically qualified me for a career in show business and comedy. So there was that.
Well, it's interesting too, because when I was a kid, strange the things mm-hmm. that people dream up. I used to fantasize, and I don't know how old I was, but I used to watch the Jackie Gleason show, and for some reason right. I used to fantasize that I was, and you'll remember, you have to be a certain age, that I was Frank Fontaine, Crazy Guggenheim, and I would do little impressions of that. But then I heard that you used to fantasize as a kid that you were on the Dean Martin show.
I just from when I was a little kid, and the thing is, at school I was funny and people laughed, and so. I kind of very early on got the idea that I could be in show business and that I could be a comedian maybe one day. And so, yeah, I just was very enamored with the idea of being on. And shows like the Dean Martin show, TV variety shows were very big back then. And the Dick Van Dyke Show is where I first heard that there was a job called TV comedy writer. Mm. And the minute I heard that was a thing that existed, that was something I wanted to do in my life. But I'm very grateful that I've gotten to do it as an adult.
So you were doing comedy in New York, and then you followed what is the usual path for people who want to make it in television. You went to Minneapolis because of a substance abuse problem, and then being in rehab helped introduce you to the guys you would work with on Mystery Science Theater 3000. Is that the path that most take?
That's in general, although they would want me to point out that I didn't meet them in rehab. I met them when I got out of rehab, and I started doing stand-up. I was born and raised in New York City, and I was asked by the city of New York to please leave because of my substance abuse problem, and I went to treatment in Minneapolis, which is the state of Minnesota is very well known for its rehab centers, and so I went there, and I just stayed there, and I started doing stand up there, and then I got on Mystery Science Theater. So, like you said, I followed the traditional show business path of moving from New York to the Midwest to get on a TV show.
And with MST 3000, you were largely responsible for picking out the films, right?
Yes, I was. Because the thing is everyone, when I first started at Mystery Science Theater, everyone on the writing staff had another skill that they also applied to the show. Like, for instance, Kevin Murphy was the editor of the film editor of the show the first year, and Trace Bilyeu and Joel Hodgson built the props for the show, and Mike Nelson wrote the music for the show. And my only skill was watching television. So I was, it became my job to screen the movies and kind of weed them out, because we got a lot of screeners to look at. And my job was to look through them and weed them out, and then present the ones that I recommended to the rest of the staff and saying, hey, what do you think about this? You know, should we do this film? And you know, so that was kind of my job, because we, like I said, we got a lot of films to look at, and people always ask me, were there movies that were too bad even for Mystery Science Theater? And the answer to that is yes. Actually, most of the films I looked at were not good enough. What you saw on the show was the cream of the crop.
Well, but what I gather, as somebody who loves all kinds of film, good, bad, and indifferent, I always got the feeling that you guys appreciated the effort of the filmmakers, even if the execution wasn't always there.
Oh, yeah, and that's only grown for me over the years. Is first of all, the people who made the films, they did all the hard work. You know, they went out and made the movie. They scouted locations. They had production meetings, and they put really all the work into it. We just like kind of added another layer of commentary over it. So, you know, I kind of look at it as a collaboration between the filmmakers, what they did, and then what we did, and then what came as a result of that was like a third thing, like a whole new kind of entertainment. And and I have great affection for the filmmakers, especially like Ed Wood, you know, and Roger Corman, and those people, you know, really had a lot of heart and really put a lot into the making of their film.
Well, you guys introduced me to Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. I thank you for that from the bottom of my heart. But, I, you know, in many ways, I think, for me, the quintessential MST 3000 film was one I never would have seen otherwise, and it wasn't a horrible film. Mitchell.
Yes, that's Mitchell. It's really interesting how that became one of our all-time iconic titles and episodes, and it wasn't in the genre that we usually did. We didn't usually do those kind of 70s detective films. You know, we did mostly sci-fi and horror kinds of movies, monster movies, and this was a 70s starring vehicle for Joe Don Baker, and it ended up becoming the most one of the most famous episodes we did. You know, anytime I want to raise my follower count on Twitter, all I have to do is write Mitchell in blockbuster, and I get like 500 retweets. You know, so yeah, it's just amazing the impact that that particular title had.
Now, I understand you're also, you mentioned you were a big Ed Wood fan, but also a Jack Webb fan.
Oh, I love Jack Webb. I still, to this day, I have episodes of Dragnet that I taped off of MeTV, and I have them, I just have them, and I, on a regular basis, I watch them, like, late at night before I go to bed, and I think Jack Webb is one of the most unique talents ever to work in television, and Dragnet is such a great show, and it's so unique. It's unlike anything else that ever was on TV. And I actually started watching the 1950s ones, which I wasn't as familiar with, and those are great too. But there's, I think the difference between the 1950s Dragnet and the late 60s ones is the 1950 ones take place in a kind of noirish L.A. world, and the 1960s ones take place in a place called Jack Webb World, which is a world unto itself, which has the same six actors in every episode playing different parts. And it just gives me so much pleasure. I can't even describe it.
And I grew up watching Dragnet and then the other Jack Webb series, like Adam 12,
yeah.
I think. Was an Emergency one of his, too?
Yeah, Emergency, Adam 12, which during the pandemic I watched every episode of Adam 12, which I like Adam 12. I don't like it as much as Dragnet. And he did Emergency and he did, there was another one with David Janssen that he did that people don't know that much about called O'Hara U.S. Treasure.
Oh, yeah. As somebody named Richard Kimball, I've always had an affinity for David Janssen.
I would bet.
Well, it was interesting.
David Janssen was great.
A couple of years ago, I caught an old film that I hadn't seen before, and I'm so used to him being Joe Friday, and I caught Jack Webb in a movie called Dark City. With Harry Morgan in it, and the guy was great. He was fantastic.
I saw that years ago, and he was a good actor, and he's very good, as I'm sure you know. He's in Sunset Boulevard, and
right.
plays a completely different kind of character from Joe Friday. Very likable, affable. In fact, he's just described as the nicest guy ever as that character. And then he's also in Marlon Brando's first movie, The Men.
Right,
He has a part in that. And then he directed several films, Pete Kelly's Blues, and the one that's the Jack Webb movie that to me is the Jack Webbiest of them all is The D.I., which he directed and stars in, and is very much a precursor to the Lee Emery character in Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket, the really hard-ass drill sergeant.
Did I read somewhere along the way that Push the Button, Frank, was a little tribute to one of my favorite movies as a kid, The Great Race?
It absolutely was. It was... Jack Lemmon and Peter Falk were kind of the template for the characters that Trace Beaulieu and I played, Dr. Forrester and TV's Frank. Jack Lemmon's character in that, he's always coming up with these weird inventions and stuff, car related, but they're all like inventions. And Peter Falk is his... bumbling assistant, and we very much had that in mind, and also Trace and I were very much influenced by old comedy teams like Abbott and Costello and Laurel and Hardy. You know, that was not that we're on the level of those people, but that's the vibe we were going for.
Well, and you guys certainly achieved that, and you still tour, doing the Mads Are Back. Trace was on with us a few years ago. Do you guys have any plans to get back on the road later this year?
I would like to. You know, we kind of took, like a lot of people did, we took a break from live performing when the pandemic hit, and I would like to get out there. Trace lives in a really nice house in the Minnesota woods, and he doesn't like to leave it. So that's a problem. He doesn't like to go out of his house or out of his property. But I hope we get back to it eventually. The cool thing is once we stopped performing live, we started doing a monthly digital streaming show. We do the second Tuesday of every month. And that's been a big success, and especially it happening when it did. You know, I'm so grateful to our fans that they supported us in doing these online shows. We've done about like 30, more than 30 of them at this point, and that's been a blast. But we both miss the sound of a live audience laughing.
I mentioned Twitter. You're a great follow there. Now, that whole saga has been interesting to watch. Do you still have your blue check mark?
I never did have a blue
check mark
in the first place. No, I could never figure out. People used to say to me, how come you don't have a blue check mark? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know what you're supposed to do to get one. I just never went about it. So now I don't have the joy of having it taken away from me. But that whole saga, as you put it on Twitter, has been, it's made, the whole Elon saga, it's made Twitter worse, but it's also been pretty entertaining to watch all the craziness that's resulted from it.
I do have to say, and I always enjoyed Twitter. It's not what it used to be, but I like to watch billionaires fail. I take some sort of bizarre satisfaction in that.
It is a really great thing to watch a billionaire who probably is surrounded by sycophants and nobody ever tells him that he's wrong about everything, doing all of these things that are just bad business decisions. Like, for instance, paying $44 billion just to have a following. I have a following and it's free. You know, it's just kind of very dumb, but fun to partake in.
Frank's new book is Dark Apnea. You can visit his website for more information at frankconniff.com. I've loved your work for a long time, Frank. It's great to finally get a chance to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast, and I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Frank Conniff on Downtown.